go to, is it going to be the case that when I know completely the configuration of reality in whatever that theory is, that I could also determine what the quantum state was? So in the quantum mechanical description, is it necessarily the case that in that deeper theory, there'll be sort of an isomorphism somehow that I'll be able to look at the hidden variable and then know what the quantum state is? So I put up this famous quote by Jaynes that I think actually appeared in a quantum optics journal or something. And I'm a quantum optician, so I quite like it. And the sentence that I particularly like, or the phrase, is, somewhere in this theory, the distinction between reality and our knowledge of reality has become lost. And that's the motivation for what I'm doing. But what I'm doing is actually playing a lot of simple mathematical games. Some of them motivated by quantum information and so on. So I'm not going to present to you sort of deep physical theories, but I'm just going to present kind of mathematical puzzles that I think might just be an interesting step towards understanding what the limitations are on any hidden variable theory. So I should start by saying what my prejudices are. I'm going to say that probabilities are epistemic. There's obviously nuances that we've already heard about in terms of that categorization. But basically, I want to imagine a deterministic universe and where probabilities arise because of my ignorance. So this sort of point of view obviously has a long history. People like Jaynes and Sir Rudolf Perls, but more recently, many people, in particular Rob, wrote a very nice summary of the arguments as part of his toy theory paper of why we should think that quantum states are epistemic. And some of the sort of motivations are based around quantum information phenomena, which are sort of easily reproduced if you take this view. And in the essential motivation, of course, I think for most of us, is that collapse, if a wave function is just a state of knowledge, then the process of collapse is analogous to updating your information about a probability distribution. Anyway, the thing which makes most of these phenomena and many others possible when you sort of think of quantum states as epistemic is that there's the two non-orthogonal quantum states behave a lot like two non-orthogonal classical probability distributions over some kind of space. So this is the sort of the driving feature of this sort of program is this analogy between non-orthogonality of quantum states and non-orthogonality of classical probability distributions, essentially no matter what space they're non-orthogonal over. Sorry. So the question then arises, if you want to push this to the extreme, is, you know, what is the information about? Okay, if I want to say a quantum state is just a state of knowledge or a state of information, what's the underlying reality? What is it information about? Now, you could say, be a radical, be Chris or some of his partners in crime and say, well, we just need a whole new type of information theory. We need to ask questions about what does it mean for something to be a general theory of knowledge and then try and sort of generalize the whole concept of what a theory of knowledge or theory of information is, and then recover, you know, the features that are specific to quantum mechanics. Or you can be like me, much older than Chris, or at least possibly wiser, and take the old sort of fuddy-duddy view and say, well, I don't really yet have a good reason to believe that I can't find some kind of description of reality in which the quantum state is just a probability distribution over some sort of hidden variables or something that I'll call ontic states. So that's the sort of view which says classical information theory, classical probability theory is the right way of going, but we just have to find a way of finding some isomorphism between quantum states and sort of states of knowledge in this deeper theory. So that's the program that I'm going to tell you about. And in particular, the sort of the key question is summarized in this slide. So what I really want to know is it possible to find some mapping where I take, you know, a quantum state psi and I find some space of hidden variables. Let's not worry about what they are yet. And I say that this state is a probability distribution over these hidden variables. And this state, which is non-orthogonal, is also a probability distribution. But that these two probability distributions have non-trivial over them. In particular, if I knew that the sort of value of the hidden variable or the ontic state, the state of reality of the system, whatever it is, happened to have this value, then I couldn't know in a classical probability theory, I don't know whether or not the corresponding quantum state is psi 2 or psi 1 because of the overlap here. Now, we call that a psi epistemic theory, if I can find a theory like that. And Rob wanted me to explain in a nice glib sentence exactly why we would call it psi epistemic. The basic idea is that if I knew the state of reality and I can't infer what the quantum state is, then the quantum state really looks like something like a state of knowledge of people. Two people might assign different quantum states to the same state of reality. Is that how you wanted me to say it, Rob? That's good. So the terminology was, so let me just go on and say what the alternative, of course, is something that we would call psiontic, where the quantum state is uniquely determined by what the value of the hidden variable is. Okay, so here, only these hidden variable states are consistent with psi 2, and only these ones are consistent with psi 1. And so it might still be probabilistic, but it seems like a much more trivial type of probability theory. And certainly, you know, you can then argue about what that really would tell you as a hidden variable theory. And the reason why Rob's concerned is that he invented this terminology, psi-stepping and psiontic, and he wanted me to explain it, which he told me in an email late last night when I was preparing this talk. So in the end, I decided to give you, here's the paper in which you can read more carefully the distinctions between these types of models. And if nothing else, you can get a recipe for cupcakes if you read the paper. So, and this was a paper with my student, Nicholas Harrigan, who doesn't make very good cupcakes. I'm hoping it's Rob's recipe. Okay, so I'm going to use a terminology which I think is just a bit less loaded than hidden variable theories. So I'm going to call these hidden variable theories ontological models, and partly to represent the fact it's kind of mathematical games that I'm playing here, but partly because there's such a sort of metaphysical baggage, or let's say historical baggage, in the terminology hidden variable theories. And it sort of covers a large subset of hidden variable theories, I would say. And when I give this talk, or sort of a version of this talk, to quantum information people, it's quite easy to motivate the program by saying, understanding the differences in these ontological models can give us information or insight into the power of quantum information, because these models in some sense are classical. They behave, you know, like classical information theory in some sense. And so if you understand what the overhead is in representing quantum mechanics by kind of essentially a classical information theory, you learn something about, well, we hope that you learn something about what it is that gives quantum computers their power. Okay, so here's the sort of definition of an ontological model, a bit more precisely than what I've said. What we basically want to do is to go, and I'm going to talk only about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces here. We want to go from, we're in quantum mechanics where we have our sort of space of wave functions is CD. I'm going to have some space, I'm not going to say particularly what it is yet, which will be the space of hidden variables or ontic states in the ontological model. And What I want to do is to find a mapping between every quantum state, psi, and some probability distribution, some positive normalized. This is not a quasi-probability distribution. This is a sort of a valid classical probability distribution, which I can index by psi, the quantum states, a p psi of lambda d lambda, and lambda is some element of the space. And what I want to do is to find a way of representing, I'm not going to talk about evolution, but just find a way of representing the states as these probability distributions and measurements as essentially, I'm going to talk primarily or only about deterministic theory. So a measurement is the measurement device receives the system. The preparation device is just preparing the state and, you know, that corresponds to this kind of value of lambda, but we don't know which value of lambda it is. When the measurement device receives the system, it has to decide which outcome am I going to give if the measurement in the quantum case is given by some set of projection operators. Then in the hidden variable theory, I have a set of what we call characteristic functions or indicator functions, which are all just have values 0 and 1. And they just indicate the probability that if the hidden variable state is lambda, that I would get, say, the outcome pi 0 or the outcome pi 1 and so on. Okay, so mathematically, all I'm asking for is sort of some normalized probability distributions and these indicator functions which tell, which sort of describe the action of the measurement device. And I want to reproduce the Born rule. Okay, so the goal is to sort of show that I can do this mapping in such a way that the Born rule in the quantum case is given by the integral of this probability distribution that corresponds to the quantum state times this function which just takes a value 0 or 1 according to whether this value of lambda gives this outcome k. So that's the basic setting. I hope that's clear. If it's not, stop me. I'm the sort of speaker that quite happy to be interrupted and yelled at. But so this is the sort of the basic mathematical framework. Now, in Bell, so I'm going to now give you an example of an ontological model. And this one's due to Bell. And it appears in Bell's original paper where he talks about von Neumann's silly assumption. So this is the model he uses to say, look, there are hidden variable theories consistent with quantum mechanics. Von Neumann's proof must just be wrong. And so in this model, he really does have a hidden variable. What he does is he says, I'm going to take the ontic state to consist of a vector which is the same as the quantum state. So the ontic state space in Bell's model is CD union, or let's say Cartesian product, with a hidden variable, which I'll call x, which just has a value between 0 and 1. Okay? And then what the probability distribution corresponding to a quantum state psi is going to look like this. So this is very simple. It just says that on this space, CD, I've got a delta function centered at psi. So essentially, the value of the ontic state is the same as the quantum state times a uniform measure on this hidden variable. So in terms of the preparation device that has to prepare this system, what it does is it looks at what the quantum state would be, and then it sends, you know, the hidden variable is it takes the same quantum state, and then it chooses a value between 0 and 1 uniformly at random. And that it sends that as the value of x on this other hidden variable space. And then Bell said, okay, let's find a way of assigning measurements such that we reproduce the quantum statistics. So the measuring device does the following. The measuring device knows, you know, the quantum PVM that's going to be implemented. And it computes the quantum probabilities P1, P2, all the way to PD, which it can do in the hidden variable model because it knows what the value of psi is. Okay. So it goes through and it computes the values of these probabilities. And then it chooses which output to give. I wrote this. This should be 1 and this should be 2, sorry. It gives the outcome 1 if the random hidden variable is less than P1. And it gives the outcome 2 if P1 is less than X, less than P1 plus P2. So if you've ever programmed something like MATLAB or C or something to reproduce some sort of quantum phenomena using a random number generator, this is exactly what you do. You choose a random number between 0 and 1, and then you just sort of divide this space up in the following manner. So maybe I should draw it a little more explicitly here. So you just take the space, you choose your random number, you divide the space up to P1, P1 plus P2, P1 plus P2 plus P3 until you get up to here, and then you sort of look at the value of the random number that comes out the random number generator. And if, for example, X lay here, you would give the outcome 3. 1, 2, 3. This is just a standard thing that now would be, I guess in Bell's day, people didn't program so much, but this is something we do all the time. So this is why it's a deterministic model that reproduces the quantum statistics. So in terms of going back to our categorization of psiontic and psi epistemic, this model is clearly a psiontic model. Because if I know the value of the hidden variable, I know what the quantum state is. The distribution, you can think of the hidden variable space as the Cartesian product of kind of the quantum space CD, and this hidden variable that lies between 0 and 1. And the probability distribution is a Dirac delta function at the quantum state times a uniform distribution along X. And so every probability distribution corresponding to a different quantum state is disjoint. So if I knew the value of the hidden variable at some point, then I know what the quantum state is. So this is what we would call a psiontic model. Okay, so, and here I drew sort of what the characteristic functions do. They just divide the space up in a way that decides which outcome the measurement's going to correspond to. So the question that naturally arises is, you know, do these models have to be psiontic? And in another famous paper in the foundation's community, Koshin and Specker gave a simple model that works on a qubit in the case of 2 dimensions, which they were giving as a way of showing that their theorem failed in 2 dimensions. But that happens to be also a psi epistemic model, and so I thought I would run through this model quickly with you. So in this Koshin-Specker model, the quantum state space is C2, and the hidden variable space is also going to be C2. You can think of it either as C2 or as the Bloch sphere, basically. And when the quantum state is psi, the hidden variable probability distribution consists of essentially what looks like a cosine distribution that has its peak centered at the state psi. So this is the Bloch sphere representation of the qubit. This p psi of lambda just sort of falls down like a cosine distribution on the hemisphere that's defined by the quantum state psi. Okay, so this is a particularly, they sort of chosen a particular shape of distribution. But clearly, this distribution, if I choose a different state psi prime here, there's clearly an overlap between these distributions. So this is going to be a psi epistemic model. And if you, the measurements also take a very simple form. So if you want to know, you know, I'm doing a measurement that projects onto, say, the 0-1 basis or something, and I want to know, I look at the value of the hidden variable, I say, which outcome should I give? Essentially, you look at the value of the hidden variable and you say, which of these states am I closest to? So it's each hemisphere, the indicator functions are just sort of a bowl on each hemisphere. So It's kind of like you turn the light on, you just see which hemisphere is the system in, and that's the outcome that you give. And what they show is that this reproduces the statistics of projective measurements on a single qubit. Okay? And because these distributions have non-trivial intersection, we would call this a psi epistemic model. So here, if you want to write the sort of constraint a bit more formally, I said that if the system is in state lambda, it gives the outcome 0, 1, according to which projected is closest to. This is the way I intuitively think about it because of what I'm about to talk about. But you could write it in terms of some kind of step functions over the block sphere if you wanted to. So we know you can do a psi epistemic model for a qubit. So the question that I started playing around with a few years ago was, well, can I do the same thing for a qutrit? Okay, can I do something very similar? And the natural thing to do was to essentially try and build something identical to the Cochen-Spaeckel model or as close as I could get. So in this qutrit model that I played around with, like with the Cochen-Spaeckel qubit model, I kept the space, the hidden variable space, to be the same as the quantum Hilbert space. So it's not a hidden variable. The spaces are sort of the same in some sense. And then I took a probability distribution that corresponds to the quantum state psi to be something which also falls off like a cosine distribution. But now you have an extra degree of freedom, which was that in the qubit model, it was kind of natural that this distribution fell off all the way down just on one half of the block sphere. But here I had to insert some parameter delta, which decided where I was going to cut this off in the Hilbert space. So it was just sort of a distribution that falls off like a cosine, symmetrically centered around the value of the hidden variable that's the same as the quantum state, but it falls off for some distance delta, which at this point is just a free parameter. And so figuratively, it looks like this. Here's the distribution. I'm centered at the value of the hidden variable that's the same as the quantum state, and I have some radius delta. And so then you have to say, well, how am I going to talk about measurements in this model? And so I decided to use something very similar to what Cochen-Spaeckel did. I said, when the system comes in with some value of the hidden variable, I'm going to just, because the hidden variable itself is a vector in the Hilbert space, it's just going to give whichever of the three projection operators in the Hilbert space it's closest to. It's going to give that outcome. Okay, so it's a very simple rule for determining. You know, I look at the value of the hidden variable, I look at the three projection operators, and I just find which one I'm closest to in terms of the Hilbert-Schmidt distance or something, and that's the outcome I give, which looks a bit messy when you write it as Heaviside step functions, but it's easy enough to play with. And geometrically, I thought I would just show you why this now is a naturally kind of contextual model. Okay, I know I can't reproduce the statistics of a qutrit without some kind of contextuality, but this model sort of is naturally contextual, because if here is my, if these are my three orthogonal projections in this qutrit space, then the rule that I've just given you essentially says, okay, if the hidden variable comes in here, then it'll give this outcome. If it comes in this region, it'll give this outcome, and so on. But if I rotate to a different triad of projectors, okay, so now I would keep this projector the same, but I would have two different co-measured projectors. Then just the natural geometry of the space is such that values of the hidden variable here, which previously would have gone to give this outcome 0, now might come and give this outcome 1 prime. Okay. So the only states which actually would always give the outcome 0 would lie in this region here. And so a terminology which is useful for some sort of generalized analysis of contextuality in these models that I like to use is that these states are faithful to this state, whereas these values of the hidden variable are unfaithful. And any contextual hidden variable model essentially has to have this feature. There have to be some unfaithful ontic states in the model. Anyway, so the model, for what it was worth, you know, it just seemed like the most natural thing to try. And so the question was, does this reproduce the Born rule? And so it turned out to be, because you're trying to integrate over this space with the with these kind of sharply defined boundaries and so on. It turned out to be a bit of a mess to try and actually do the integration by hand. So what I did was I just did a very naive Monte Carlo sampling in MATLAB. I chose a bunch of states at random. I chose one set of projection operators, and I just tried to compute this integral numerically. And you know, after choosing about 1,000 points, I saw, okay, looks like that this here is the Born rule overlap between my randomly chosen pi naught and psi one, and this was the value that the ontological model was giving, and the differences seemed to be quite small, and so clearly I just had to do better numerics, and these would converge to this. So then I spent a week trying to prove by hand that these things were equal. Then I thought, oh, this really is a mess. So I went back and ran about 10 million points on the Monte Carlo simulation, and I found that they were actually different. And to see the biggest difference between the ontological model prediction and the quantum prediction, it suffices to consider the quantum states in a 2D subspace of the 3D space, so just parameterized by the single value theta, and look at the projections into the computational basis of this cutrid, say. And the quantum predictions are the Born rule, which are these standard cos squared theta, sine squared theta curves. And after, you know, 10 million numerical integrations, you see that the ontological model has slightly different predictions than the Born rule. And you get up to about a 2% maximum discrepancy. This here is the probability of the third outcome, which quantum mechanically would be zero. But in the ontological model, there is some sort of finite probability, about 1.5% of seeing the third outcome. So at this point, you start thinking, how well do I trust my experimental colleagues that they verify the Born rule correctly? Because it just seems like a natural thing. And so I actually work with a lot of experimentalists in optics, and I started emailing them, asking them for, how well have you really verified the Born rule? And of course, they mainly verified it for a qubit, like to high precision. But I know that there's an a psi epistemic ontological model for a qubit. So this wasn't really helping me. And eventually, you know, I decided I didn't need to book a ticket to Stockholm yet, and that actually there's good reasons to believe that this ontological model is invalid. But it's kind of a fun thing to play around with, fun idea to play around with. So then when I got discouraged, and I started thinking, maybe there are no psi epistemic models at all. And so then I tried to prove that there aren't psi epistemic models, and I failed in that attempt. And so then in discussions with John Barrett and Rob and so on, I became convinced that there are psi epistemic models. And this is the simplest example of a psi epistemic model. Doesn't satisfy a lot of the things I would like in a psi epistemic model. But I've never really published this, and I thought, well, maybe it's worth just explaining to people that it is possible to have a psi epistemic model at some level. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take Bell's ontological model that we already talked about, which essentially was just like the equivalent of what we do with a random number generator when we simulate quantum mechanics, and I'm going to show how to turn it into something that's psi epistemic. So the way of doing this is first I have to fix a special universal state in the Hilbert space. So this state U is going to be known to every preparation device and every measurement device in the universe. And then every measurement device is defined, you know, in the quantum case by some PVM. Every measurement device, this is more for the simplicity of explaining what's going on, but basically every measurement device is going to reorder the labeling of its outcomes in such a way that the overlap between projection operator pi 1 and this universal state is larger than the overlap between projection operator pi 2 and the universal state, and so on. So that these probabilities form a kind of decreasing sequence. And then the overall idea is the following. If the state psi that the preparation device is meant to be preparing is close enough to this universal state, and if X, the extra supplementary variable that Bell introduced, is small enough, then for sure the pi 1 outcome will be the result. And we can replace this. So this here would have been the hidden variable in Bell's original model. It consists of the quantum state and the supplementary variable. I can replace this psi by any other psi prime, as long as it's also close enough to psi and u. So this is the general idea. A bit more precisely, we do it like this. For the moment, just imagine that I have a function that I can compute for any quantum state psi, given that I know u. So this function is going to depend on this universal state. And this function f of psi forms a lower bound for the overlap between psi and the projection of pi 1. Now, this doesn't depend on pi 1. So it says, for any measurement device, I can compute this thing with psi. And I know that the probability that the Born rule sort of overlap between psi and pi 1 is greater than this thing here. Remember, pi 1 is special because it's the guy that had the largest overlap with the universal state. So the measurement device has chosen pi 1 to be the guy that's got the largest overlap with the universal state. So this here, you know, it's important that this is pi 1. And then the preparation device is going to play the following game. If I was giving this talk in quantum information, I would talk about Alice and Bob and sending a different information. But basically, the preparation device does the following. First, it chooses this uniform random variable that Bell used. Then it computes this lower bound, f of psi. And if this random variable is less than this lower bound, f of psi, then it prepares the ontic state, which consists of psi prime and x, where psi prime is any other state such that f of psi prime is also greater than x. But if it's not, if x is not less than this lower bound, then it does what Bell, what the hidden variable was in Bell's model. It prepares psi and x. Okay. So the reason that this works is that if x is less than this lower bound, then essentially the preparation device knows that for sure the pi 1 outcome will be obtained at the measurement device. And so we can just choose some other state which also for sure, because of this thing, also for sure will let the will ensure that the pi 1 outcome is obtained. So in fact, you know, it could just send a classical message and say, hey, give the 1 outcome. So this is not the most attractive model one could have imagined. I have to first also convince you, sort of here's just to show you that I can find such a suitable lower bound. And that's just to do with the geometry of states in the Hilbert space. So what we know is that what we're trying to do is find a lower bound on the overlap between psi and this pi 1. And pi 1 is the projector which is closest to the universal state. So what that allows us to do is know that this overlap must be bigger than 1 on D, where D is the dimension of the Hilbert space, because pi 1 is the largest probability. The largest probability when you do a projective measurement must always be greater than or equal to 1 on D, where D is the dimension of the space. And just sort of geometry tells me that this angle must be less than the sum of these two angles. This lets me put a lower bound on cos squared alpha, which I can write in terms of this overlap. And so I get some f of psi here, which the important thing is that it depends only on psi and on this universal state and on the dimension d, okay, which is sort of known to the device. So what that shows is then that the construction that I gave on the previous slide will work, that there does exist such a function. And so it says that we can have a psi epistemic model. We can turn Bell's model into a psi epistemic model, but in a way that that at least some of the time, when I look at the ontic state of the system, I can't infer what the quantum state was. When x happens to be small enough in Bell's model and psi happens to be close enough to the universal state, then in those situations, the preparation device sends me an ontic state, and I don't know what. I don't know what the actual quantum state corresponding to that preparation would have been. So the preparations correspond to at least some of these quantum states of overlapping distributions. Of course, this is not what we want. We want something kind of where every quantum pair of non-orthogonal quantum states have some kind of overlap and so on, and where I respect the symmetries of the situation and so on. So this is not something I'm proposing as, you know, a fundamental theory of nature. It's about as ugly a psi epistemic model as you can get. But it does tell me that at least it's possible to have a psi epistemic model. And I promised Rob I wouldn't put this picture of him up, but decided to break that promise. So, yeah. Okay. So the second route to getting psi epistemic models, or the sort of second part of this program on ontological models, I just want to tell you a little bit about. What the idea of this part of the program was to, instead of trying to start with a model that reproduces everything, try and start with a model that can reproduce a finite amount of experimental data, and then sort of ask, as I get more and more experimental data, can I make this model reproduce all of this experimental data? So what we're trying to do is look at, for given a sort of finite amount of experimental data, what is the smallest number of ontic states that I would need in an ontological model to reproduce this data? So this seems like an interesting thing to look at, partly for quantum information reasons. You know, a quantum computer kind of implement, a classical computer can implement an ontological model. It's a classical model. And so looking at the number of ontic states seems like an interesting way of selling foundations in a research proposal. So it's the kind of game I played for a little while with Nick Harrigan, I should say. So the basic construction is this. I have a data table. I just imagine I have some finite amounts of data. These here are the frequencies of this measurement. So this is measurement number one, measurement number two. So think of these like the quantum projections, outcome number one, two, and three. And I build up this data. These probabilities sum to one, these probabilities sum to one, and so on. And these just correspond to different preparation configurations. So this is kind of like doing one. I don't know, say in Lucien's paper, look at the build up a finite amount of data for one of these kind of very operational procedures. So we call this a data table. Quantum mechanically, you know, this entry of the data table is given by the overlap of some projection operator that corresponds to measurement two and outcome three with the state psi, which corresponds to preparation procedure one. Okay? So an interesting open question that I just thought I would throw out as an aside, and that's still open, is there an efficient algorithm to find the smallest Hilbert space dimension required to represent an arbitrary data table in terms of pure states and projective measurements? So if I just give you some set of data and I say, you know, this has been reproduced by a set of events, you know, I did some measurements and so on, can you find what's the smallest Hilbert space dimension it would take to reproduce that amount of data? And at the moment, it's an open question whether there is an efficient algorithm to do so. But we can find algorithms that work. And I've given, you know, I don't want to go into the details of how we do it. But what we do, basically, is we rewrite the problem as a matrix factorization. So the data table we write as the product of a measurement matrix and a preparation matrix. The preparation matrix, the column vector here, is just my classical probability distribution corresponding to preparation one. This is the classical probability distribution corresponding to preparation two. And these rows of this matrix are the indicator functions for the measurement. So when I multiply this row times this column, I sum up the first three entries here and I get this outcome zero. But if I multiply this row times this column, I sum up the these three entries and I get this probability two-thirds and so on. So this is just a formal way of writing mathematically an ontological model over a finite number of ontic states. And of course, it's a deterministic model, so this matrix has to be built out of zeros and ones. Notice that in this particular, what I would call ontological factorization, is psi epistemic. This preparation procedure and this preparation procedure, the probability distributions overlap on two out of the nine ontic states. Okay. So the intuition is, well, if I'm going to find efficient representations of this stuff, reducing the number of ontic states, then surely I'm going to end up with psi epistemic models. It'll always make sense to sort of have overlapping distributions. But one has to be careful, because for the same data table, there's a factorization in terms of only 7 ontic states, so 2 less than in the previous case, and that gives back the same data table. And this one's now psiontic. This distribution is disjoint from this distribution. So it turns out to be a tricky game to come up with procedures that compress the number of ontic states in one of these ontological factorizations. But what I want to show you is kind of the result of one of the compression algorithms for a particular data table that is interesting, because it's the data table that corresponds to one demonstration of Cochin-Specker type of measurement contextuality. So it's an example due to Kernighan that you can find in Perez's book. It consists of states in a 20 different states in a 4-dimensional space. So this is my data table where the values I've had to color code to make it not look crazy, and these blue lines just represent that each measurement outcome has it's in a 4D space. So these are projectors in a 4D space. So there's 11 different PVMs and 20 different states that build up this data table, and if you look this set of 4 projectors and this set of 4 projectors share an element in common, and so that's why this row of the data table must be identical to this row of the data table. Okay, so it's in the standard Cochin-Specker way. I have these 11 different sets of projectors, and they share different elements in common, and you can build up a standard Cochin-Specker contradiction from this. Now, there's a psiontic factorization of this data table. So here's the data table in terms of this measurement thing. So the rows of this are the indicator functions. And this here is the matrix of the preparation. So you see that every probability distribution, every column here is disjoint. And I can find ways of the black here are ones and the white are zeros of sort of adding up these entries to reproduce this data table. And if I look at the particular rows that corresponded, that are in the previous example, to the same projector, you see something that has to be true. When an ontological model reproduces contextual data, these rows will not necessarily be the same. So there'll be sort of, and it's quite difficult to see, I'm sorry, but there's sort of at least one value here which is different. Here there's a white square, here there's a black square. And what that says is that if this PVM is being measured and the ontic state happens to correspond to this value, then in this PVM, I wouldn't get that outcome. But in this PVM, I would get that outcome. Okay. So this is just how contextuality manifests itself in these ontological models. Now, I think a really interesting question, and I don't understand why we're not pushing it harder, except maybe it's too difficult, is to lower bound the amount of contextuality that you need to reproduce things. Cochin-Specker theorem and then Rob's generalized versions of contextuality tell us you need some contextuality. But I think it's a fascinating question, which is, how much contextuality do you really need? Can we sort of put a lower bound that says you need a really contextual thing? Or you know, is there some sort of finite amount in some well-defined sense of contextuality that you need? I don't know how easy or hard a problem it is. I can give examples where you need more than, say, these standard Cochin-Specker constructions. But in terms of this ontological factorization stuff, a question which is dual to that is like minimizing these number of ontic states. And here in this one, I had 82 ontic states, and I started messing around with algorithms. And it turns out that image compression algorithms that are used by classical computer scientists and so on, and engineers, can be cooked in a way. Unfortunately, they work quite efficiently for image compression. Here we have some extra constraints. So for example, here, only one value in every 4 elements here can actually be equal to 1. I can't have 2 measurement outcomes both corresponding to this value of the ontic state in this PBN. So that puts some extra constraints, but you can mess around with these image compression algorithms, and then you just run it, and some of them are random algorithms, so each time you run it, you get a different number of ontic states. And the sort of record for doing this, I ran an image compression algorithm and managed to find this particular ontological factorization of the same data table that only uses 42 ontic states. Again, it's essentially just a mathematical game, but I think that by doing this, we can look at some quantitative questions of you know, efficient representations in ontological models, efficient representations of quantum things, whether or not you believe that that necessarily has anything to do with the foundations of physics. If you have students who want to do foundations but don't want to jeopardize their career, I think there's a lot of fun things that they could do. Okay, so I think I'll just conclude with some final words and kind of why I'm skeptical of everything I've just told you about. The first is, I guess it's easiest to phrase like this, if you give me some data table, it's fairly simple to show that you give me any amount of data table, you give me any size data table, that there always exists some set of states in a Hilbert space and some set of projection operators which will reproduce these overlaps by the Born rule. So in that sense, the Hilbert space structure of quantum mechanics, you know, is essentially unfalsifiable if what you mean is just states and projection overlap projection operators. It's not even a physical theory, because you can't give me any data that I can't reproduce like this. So and this I invite you just as an exercise to try and show. I said it now for my undergrad quantum undergrad students every year to try and get them out of the mindset that they're in. But so it says that, you know, what I've been doing so far is trying to reproduce this Hilbert space structure in these kind of abstract models. But, you know, there has to be more constraints on it. There has to be something to do with the efficiency of representing the data table. Or in particular, the things that I can't do is if I add in some extra assumptions, like, you know, measurements at different space, like a space like separated measurements should commute, then I can't reproduce every data table that way. But those are kind of extra physical assumptions, and I started thinking, you know, is that why I really believe in quantum mechanics, because it reproduces kind of data tables for me? And, you know, it isn't. I think I followed Carl Cave's to a large extent in seeing that, you know, these programs which are based on sort of just looking at the abstract Hilbert space structure can only take us so far, and that ultimately we have to ask the questions of, you know, what are the fundamental Hamiltonians? Why does canonical quantization work when we go into this thing? When I, to argue slightly with Rudiger yesterday, when I see a preparation device, I don't write down a density matrix. I open the thing, I look at the lasers and the nonlinear crystal in there, and I solve the Hamiltonian. That Hamiltonian is eigenstates, and then my prior is actually a Hamiltonian. My prior is my best guess as to a simple Hamiltonian that I can simulate on a classical computer, which might tell me something about the preparation procedure. And I think that in terms of this whole program, until we really get to the nitty-gritty you know, why Hamiltonians work and why I can go from these classical Hamiltonians and so on, I think we're going to be missing out on a lot of the physics. So I thought I would conclude with that point, or more likely to say, look, psi epistemic models are possible. There's some nice quantitative problems, but if you're going to solve them, you better find a student who's smarter than me. Use a microphone.
Thanks, Howard Wiseman. A completely non-philosophical question.
Okay, that's your question.
It is working. Can everybody
don't
hear
give,
me?
Don't give him another yes, question.
So maybe I just missed it, but when you were looking for small ontological models that would explain your data set, were you constraining to look for psi-ontic models?
No, they were psi-epistemic. After I did that image compression, then you see that these probability distributions now overlap. Like, if you look at each column, there's going to be some values which overlap.
Okay, so the first example was...
The first example was psi-ontic because it turns out to be quite easy to find a psi-ontic model and then just shove that through the compression and see, and typically you expect to get out a psi-epistemic model.
Right. Okay.
Have you looked at the Wiener-Siegel hidden variable model?
Not.
Oh, I strongly recommend it as a, I think it's an example of a psi-epistemic model, a very nice one. There's a very good treatment in Belinfanti's book about hidden variables. It's essentially that there's a dual Hilbert space, that's the hidden variables. When you put a system in a state, you give a probability distribution to the various state vectors in the dual Hilbert space, and if you make a measurement in any other direction in Hilbert space, there's a rule for which way the various states respond. I think it's a very lovely model.
That sounds very interesting.
I wanted to ask why it wasn't a good example of such a thing, because I'm not as
So typically,
recommended anyway.
People typically, I mean, I've looked at a lot of models, and Rob has, and I don't know if Rob knows this particular model or Nick has, and typically, but Ertz has a bunch of models and so on. Typically, you have to look carefully at really what the state of reality is. So in Bohmian mechanics, you might say, well, the position is the real thing. But in fact, you also need to know the wave function to know the quantum potential. So if you can, you know, if I gave you the actual, if you were, you know, a Bohmian god and you knew everything in the universe, you would know what the quantum state was. You would be able to retrodict that. And so typically with these models, that turns out to be the case. But because I believe that there are psi-epistemic models, I'll definitely look it up, and it's very interesting. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Anthony Valentini. Very interesting talk. Just something I'm a bit puzzled by. When you say that you have this example showing that you can have psi-epistemic theories, you say that for that theory, at least some quantum states have overlapping distributions.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the basis for saying that it's a psi-epistemic theory. Maybe there's something I've misunderstood here. I would have sort of expected that almost all quantum states would have to have overlapping distributions.
Right.
The reason I say that, I mean, here's an example. Let's just look at the two-dimensional, the qubit. I could have a sort of peculiar theory where I say, okay, for one half of the Bloch sphere, my hidden variables theory is the Bell model with an ontic quantum state, and for the other half of the Bloch sphere, it's the Cochin-Specker model.
Yeah.
And in that theory, it would be a hidden variables theory, it'd be a bit crazy, but in that theory, some quantum states would have overlapping distributions. And I
agree.
That would seem to me a theory where one would say, well, it's partially psi-epistemic or something like
no,
that.
No, I agree 100%. Like, it's just, let's say, an initial step. But so obviously we want to make more strict what we really mean by psi-epistemic. So, you know, what we really want is exactly what you're saying, that every pair of non-orthogonal quantum states, the way they manifest their non-orthogonality is purely by this lack of information. And we don't have an example like that or that I know of. But if you ask Joe Emerson for Ryan Morris's master's student's thesis, I don't know if Joe is here, but his student goes through and tries to give some tighter definitions and you know, sort of look at some progress. I mean, there's interesting things still to be said even about the Cochin-Specker model. So that student shows you can't even reproduce single qubit POVMs in the Cochin-Specker model and so on.
So would it be fair to say that really We don't yet have an example of a psi epistemic model.
Let's say we don't have an example of a completely psi epistemic
model. Right, okay, yeah. Good. Fair enough, good.
But even if that was completely psi epistemic, it's so ugly that I wouldn't think that it actually gave us any insight about nature, to be honest. You know, these are mathematical games at the moment.
You said you wanted a quantitative measure of the contextuality in a data table. I don't know whether this will help in any way, but Itamar Potofsky has a paper where he shows that if you start with a set of proposed projection operators, so these would correspond to measurements, or we start with a set of vectors, mm-hmm. and if they have any non-orthogonal ones in the set, so they're not all orthogonal to each other, but there's some that are non-orthogonal. Mm-hmm. Then he gives a construction where he can embed all of these guys into orthogonal bases. So he starts adding vectors and adding more and more until he gets a Cochin-Specker contradiction. So he gets a non-colorable set. He gives an algorithm for it, so that's point number one. Point number two is he puts an estimate on how many you have to add in order to get a non-colorable set. So he gets a bound on how many you have to add. Mm-hmm. Now, so you might take that as a measure of the contextuality of that set. I don't know whether it has any connection to this, I just thought I'd mention it.
But that's the sort of game that I'd like to play, find just a procedure for doing it. But I think that it's more than, you see, what he's saying there is, okay, then I end up with a set in which at least one element of that set of projectors has to take two different colors.
Yeah.
But can I come up with a set where I can force any element and say, you know, this element, every element in the set has to, at some point, be in one of two different colors, for example?
Oh, that's a nice question. Yeah.
It's just a comment on your open question. I think there was a work by Antonio Artin and Nicola Gizan and I think Valerio Scarani, maybe a few other people, on estimating dimension of the Hilbert space on the base of the database of measurement mm-hmm. results on local measurements for correlated systems.
Entangled systems, yeah.
Entangled systems. And there's some kind of semi-definite programs for that.
There is for that case, and we raised this question, I guess, before they published that paper, although, of course, they didn't cite us. But the general question, I think, is NP-hard. It's a guess based on a guess of Scott Aronson, so it's like a guess on a guess. But I don't think the general question would be very easy, but I'm not sure.
So this goes back to Anthony's question. So in all your models, they are basically static. They don't evolve dynamics of the ontic state. So right. I think one could improve the definition of a psi epistemic theory by looking at a particular feature of the Breuler-Bohm theory, namely that an individual system, the evolution of an individual system, depends on the wave function. And you can take that as a criteria for a theory or an ontological model to be psi-ontic. How would you do that more precisely? You need to have a broad framework of ontological models and their dynamics. A natural way to do that is considering transition rates and so on. You have an ontological space, and there's such and such probability for non-ontic states to move here. And you would require that the transition rates would be independent of psi. And that's a pretty strong requirement.
Yeah, and I think that, so I didn't talk about dynamics at all. Certainly in Rob and Nick's paper and various other papers that we've written, we've done this, that, you know, sort of look at transition matrices as the way of implementing dynamics. I think for something like the Cochin-Specker model and then my sort of failed Q-Trit model, the nice thing was because the hidden variable space was still just Hilbert space, the dynamics would have just been rotations of that space. So you would have had unitary evolution come out naturally as, you know, the dynamics and Hamiltonians would have been the same. So it would have been nice. But I think what you're saying about defining, I think that, so this is a point that you've made to me in the past, and I think it's an important point, which is that if you have dynamics that depends on psi and you start doing the sorts of things Anthony's talked about, where you can do kind of supercomputing and so on. It's still unclear to me whether that's really due to anything quantum. If I could do classical computing and then make something depend on the probability distribution in the classical computer, I'm pretty sure I could solve NP-complete problems too. So this, you know, I'm not sure that really tells us anything about the ontic epistemic divide between classical probability distributions and the quantum state. No.
I just wanted to mention an interesting problem that I think these techniques could shed some light on. So Matt Leifer defined something called hypercontextuality. Together with John Barrett and I, we've been working on this. And the idea is that imagine an arbitrary theory that has some data table. It could happen that just like Popescu-Rohrlich boxes are more non-local than correlations we see in quantum mechanics, there are theories that have more contextual statistics than quantum theory. And for such a theory, you could ask not, you know, what are the probability distributions and indicator functions that represent this, but what quantum states and projectors can represent this. But now a particular outcome or a pair of outcomes from two different measurements that have the same statistics in the theory could be represented by different projectors in your model. So you would have mm-hmm. different projectors for the same measurement outcome. Right, so it'd be hyper-contextual in the sense.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so I think all these techniques can apply to that question as well.
Yeah, that's interesting.